Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Really excited today because we're going to do some 17th century history. We have with us Louisiana historian and author Heather Thornton, who is a specialist nonetheless in British Stuart history and restoration, in specifically the church. So welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
You have, and we also have Erica, don't we, who's, because it is 6 a.m. in Louisiana, so she's asleep. She's going to sleep through this.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Bless her. I heard a yawn and she didn't sound like she was inclined to get involved in the story. But this is a rollicking story you've got for us, isn't it?
It is. It's the best of, it's one of my favorites that I found researching in different bits. And when I kept finding, when I was, you know, sometimes you know, you're in the archive and you're researching something and you're like, oh wait, this is fun. Wait, there's more. And you're like, I need to find out what happened. And
rabbit holes that are more interesting than your actual point of research.
Well, it actually tied into my research. So it's, you know, it's
excellent.
In my book, but at the same point is it's such a fantastically like vicious story. And it just kind of, it encapsulates kind of that restoration, kind of the nastiness afterwards with, you know, there's so much vitriol that's in the press and just with the different sides that it just, you know, and this, you think of like the church and it's like, oh, they should be, hey, you know, no, there was a lot of, and this one is the best because it has all of the characters. You've got the king, you've got the bishops, the deans, like everyone's angry.
It's always better when it's people who should know better, isn't it?
You know, you would think so. It doesn't always work that way. You know, they sometimes are like, no, we're good. And there were two other dioceses, Canterbury and Norwich also had conflict, but they handled it appropriately where Lichfield did not.
Yeah.
They ended up, it took 20 years, two archbishops, you know, and the Court of Arches. Samuel Pepys even writes about it in his diary and his daily gossip. I mean, it just goes, it keeps, it just turned and turned and turned because it was just like, no, I'm not going to do it.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning with people then. What was the most pressing issue facing the Church of England at the Restoration?
One of the most pressing problems was finding enough people to fill the vacancies. When the Church of England was disbanded in the 1640s, so many people just were sequestered, they lost their livings, and so those churches were just empty for the most part. Some were used by different sectaries, but most of them were empty. And so they were huge gaping holes over most of the nation. Like something about like, you know, there's estimates, they're not of like between 60 and 90% were empty at different points. So there's a huge number of vacancies, including most of the Episcopal sees were vacant just through death, or, you know, for the part, or like three or four surviving bishops at the Restoration. And the only real requirement that they needed at the time, at the Restoration in 1660, was that the men had to have Episcopal ordination. They had to have, like, taken their oath, had to be ordained by a bishop. And that opens up a whole host of other issues later on.
So how did the Act for Settling Ministers create issues within the church?
The Act for Settling Ministers comes out of this sort of like, okay, we just need them to be episcopally ordained. The Act for Settling Minister basically said, okay, unless the predecessor survived, you know, someone who lost their living in the 1640s, if the predecessor still lived, the minister could leave. If they didn't, they could stay. And so long as they had an episcopal, you know, and it was just kind of like it was kind of a band-aid. Like, this is going to take us a while to fix. So let's just let everyone stay where they are. Let's not have a huge amount of upheaval. We've had so much upheaval over the last 20 years. Let everyone stay until we figure out where we're going. So it's essentially a band-aid, but it gave some people a sense of security that their livings or just places were secure. And there'll be an ejection when the Act of Uniformity is passed. In 1662, where you have to bow the knee, you have to agree with prayer book orthodoxy, which is one of the main tenets that's going to come about, and that's going to cause a lot of conflict, and it'll be the core of the conflict at Lichfield, is whether or not you can enforce prayer book orthodoxy.
Okay, so how do they try and settle these disputes?
The established way is, if you have a dispute within a diocese, you go through the bishop's court. There's a process where Ideally, you want it preferred. They wanted it done according to the canons. And the canons, like, basically you had a series of rules. You had to bring your evidence. You had to bring your complaint. You filed a formal complaint, depending on who was, you know, the cathedral clergy. You have prebends, canons, the dean, and the bishop. And depending on who was going, you would always go to the next person in line. A prebend would go to a canon would go to the dean could go to the bishop. What happens is that you want to, like, kind of keep it in order, and the bishop is the final arbiter. Like, once the bishop has ruled in his court, the matter should be settled. The bishop could lay down judgment, so to speak, just like, you know, because the it's part of the service of the ecclesiastical courts. But it only worked if everyone followed all of the steps. So everyone has to agree that this is the way we want it done. Because without it, you know law, how law goes. There are certain things. You have to enter a plea. You have to do this, do that. And the English, the ecclesiastical courts were much like the English courts, that you had to follow the steps. And if somebody refuses to enter a plea or something, you have to, like, reinvent the wheel, so to speak, to kind of figure out how to move from it. And so basically that was the preferred method. This is what happens in Canterbury and in Norwich. They follow the rules, so to speak, and find a solution, and everyone goes along their merry way. They may not like it, but they don't fight it like Woodville at Litchfield.
Right. So what conflict existed within the church, and what modes existed to solve problems?
The biggest conflict initially was how do you fill the vacancies? Yeah. And the next big thing is, how do you fill the bishoprics? Who are going to be the bishops? And who are going to name the bishops? Archbishop Juxton survived. He was Archbishop of Canterbury. He survived through the Restoration. But by 1660, he was incredibly old and in very poor health. I think he was like 78 at the Restoration. And he had been very inactive during the 1640s and 50s. And much of the survival of the Church of England in the Interregnum had fallen upon university men. And people who had real close connections to Charles I, they had been royal chaplains, and they are the men who get elevated. These are men with very strong royalist pedigrees who did lose and suffer a great deal, but also who had communicated throughout the 1650s in particular about what to do when they could return. How do they fix this? And one of the ultimate things that is lost in the Restoration settlement of the Church of England is the Elizabethan settlement. The great idea of the Via Media, the Church of England being broad enough to encompass a great many deals, which you see in the early Stuart Church with, you know, having both Puritans and non and less Puritan account and Arminians being raised to bishoprics under James I, is a casualty. And part of that is due to this sort of, you know, it becomes a big problem. The church has to define itself. It's all had always kind of been vague. And what happens in the 1660s is that the Church of England is forced to finally, after, you know, being existing for 100 years or 100 plus, to finally truly define its positions, and not its theological positions. They were more outward positions, and that real kind of connection to kind of the church and the king, that kind of that real high royalist position where, you know, the church and the king were to be two pillars of society. And the Church of England was that the church that was the pillar, not all these dissenting groups that had emerged and fractured or broken society in their opinions.
It's just a mess, isn't it?
It was. It was a massive mess. And it doesn't help that throughout the 1660s, and 1660, there are like all of these groups that want to, you know, usher in, you know, the fifth monarchist and the millenarians. They're all like, ooh, we should like try to violently overthrow the government again, because that's exciting. And so there's always terror. And, you know, the big groups, some of the bigger non kind of the sectaries, the more radical ones, the Quakers, you know, conveniently became pacifist at the Restoration, despite that, you know, they had not been, which is kind of what people always are surprised by. The Quakers had like destroyed the town of Carlisle in the Civil War, like rioting, you know, so they conveniently converted to pacifism right about the Restoration and, you know, got in good and just kind of became, but it was very, there's a lot of like, all of the gray is going to be eliminated. It becomes a very stark. You either do this, this is what makes you Anglican, and this is what makes you other, versus trees or previous times where it all been like, Anglicanism was a very broad definition, like what it mattered. And this will not remain. It will actually split in the 18th century. The end of the 19th century, the non-juring schism will be part of this as well. But it just kind of like, they have to define themselves. And that's the one of the biggest issues. And they do try, they'll call a convention. At the same time Parliament meets, the bishops will be restored to the House of Lords in 1662, or very early on, as soon as the bishoprics are filled. And the bishops are all going to be filled at this point in 1660 through the office of the Chapel Royal. Charles II's royal chaplains are going to be kind of the people who promote and settle a lot of ministers, because they're the first ones who are restored. This is Gilbert Sheldon, George Morley, Matthew Wren. And they kind of take over. Sheldon will become the Bishop of London at this point, so he will be one of the primary movement shakers. But he and Morley and Wren were all associates and friends, had communicated throughout the interregnum, so they had a plan going in. And they had talked theology, written theology, discussed theology about how do we protect ourselves, don't touch that, from that happening again. And that was a real fear, that they lost so much. Some people ask, because I did my primary research on Gilbert Sheldon, who did become the Archbishop in this era. And people ask me, what do you think would have happened to Sheldon if he hadn't been Archbishop? If the Restoration, I go, his real love was the University of Oxford. He was the warden of all souls. He himself was not an academic, but he read and encouraged academics. And I think he would have ended up and just stayed there. Like, he never would have left. He would have been a grand old university don, possibly the chancellor, and he would have like had a fine, outstanding kind of academic career and never been pushed into this sort of position of prominence. But he does kind of have that kind of university background, and a lot of the men who are promoted will have similar, you know, between the visitation and the cleansing of the universities, they lost a lot. Some people survived the interregnum, and it wasn't a bad thing. A lot of the university men, you know, they don't have families. They are attacked very harshly. The universities were plundered pretty strongly, and they watched, you know, the places that they loved be destroyed. And I think that really impacted, and they feared that. And I think that's a real kind of undercurrent in some of their decisions that they make. They feared what would happen if the world turned upside down again. And so they needed to survive, but they also needed to figure out how to prevent that. And to them, those who did not toe the line, the Puritans, they could point fingers very clearly at like, hey, you dismantled my living. You destroyed my church. This, the great love of my, you know, what I did, you took it apart. And so there's a lot of that going on. And so the problems, they'll go through Parliament. When the bishops return to the House of Lords, the bishops will be very, very powerful in the Cavalier Parliament. And also they will also do conventions to reauthorize and revamp. There'll be a 1662 edition of the prayer book that will be put out. And that becomes actually the standard prayer book that all modern prayer books are based upon.
What I find so interesting about this is that there's been the upheaval of the Reformation and the Civil War. So it's like a double whammy on the church, isn't it? So the church has just been like battered from pillar to post. Jeez, at this point.
And the church, you know, it has, like, they officially disband the church in 1646. And then they start taking, and the churches in certain groups, you would think churches should be sacrosanct, that you shouldn't like attack a church or something. And there were several notable churches that will be basically pillaged. The collegiate chapels will be victims. They will all be just sort of destroyed. Christ Church in Oxford in particular will be like, they'll take all of the choir and all of the wooden ornamentation and use it for firewood. Litchfield will be complete. It takes it till the 19th century to be fully restored. They remove most of the roof. The central spire will be pulled down. All of the stained glass will be broken. I mean, so there's a lot. So some of the churches were attacked at different points by not the royalists, but the Puritans and the others and others out there. The sectaries would sometimes take their ire out on the churches, cathedral churches in particular, and the collegiate churches were looted. And if they weren't looted, they gave their money, they gave a lot of their material objects of like silver and gold, like communion plates and things to the king to fund the royalist army.
A lot of Erica is dismayed by this.
Yes, she's very dismayed.
Yeah. So can you tell us what happens at diocese level with this conflict in deanery, chapter, with the bishops?
It'll start, it kind of depends. It usually has to do with somebody doing something that they shouldn't. A lot of the time, sometimes it's kind of like, it seems very petty. Someone who is not keeping records correctly, or if they remove, there's lots of rules about like, you know, everything. There are rules about like, okay, so a prebend or a dean or canon will take the records of the church and take them to their own home. Well, that's right. Pretty bad. That's what the conflict in Canterbury was about who could keep records, because two men were eligible. And so basically they solved it by allowing each one to keep different sorts of records. So that worked. In Norwich, the dean at the time, Edward Reynolds was bishop there. And the dean basically took the communion vessels to use in his own home, like to pour wine for himself. He also,
it's like when you work in a bar and you start kidnapping all the plates and cutlery and glasses.
Yeah, it's pretty much. You can't go and take it, and use it at your own house. And then he also had a reputation for being someone of he was a striker. He liked to fight. those were managed in-house. Like, you know, they were done, you know, they followed the rules. Everyone was kind of brought to toe the line. They were forced to, like, you know, make obedience to the bishop and agree not to do such things, return what they had taken. And that's where Lichfield differs, because it doesn't work that way. You know, Norwich and Canterbury shows this is how it's supposed to work. Like, everyone does what they're supposed to. Everyone follows the rules, the steps. Everyone listens to the bishop's judgment and follows the bishop's judgment. And in Lichfield, none of this happens.
Why are we looking at such nonsense in Lichfield and Coventry?
Lichfield and Coventry, a lot of it has to do with what happened to Lichfield in the Civil War. Lichfield was under siege three different times, twice by the parliamentary forces and once by the royalists to take it back. The cathedral there was badly damaged, as I said earlier. The roofs, the central spires, all the stained glass was destroyed. And so whoever was going to come into the diocese, and Lichfield is a split diocese. It's Lichfield and Coventry. So that's already problematic. It's not one spot. But the cathedral is in Lichfield, which is where the bishop will live and the deans and the canons and all that. So whoever is going to be elevated to the see in Lichfield is going to have a huge undertaking. They're going to have to work toward the restoration of the cathedral. But also Lichfield, because it had a huge number of sectaries, Presbyterians in particular, that were in the city or in that diocese, it was a hotbed of nonconformist thought. So both, not only do you have we've destroyed the cathedral, but also there's been a lot of nonconformists hanging about here for a very long time, and they're very well established. And so it's kind of it's a double problem of what's happening at Lichfield. And that's going to be a very difficult thing to fix as John Hackett, who will become the Bishop of Lichfield and Coventry in 1661, will find out.
Yeah, so these are our main characters, aren't they? John Hackett and Thomas Wood. So who are they?
Hackett was a royalist. He had been a chaplain, actually. He'd been a royal chaplain to James I. And in the Civil War, he had lost most of his livings. He kept one. He was a married man. He had kids, so he basically had to keep them for himself. Like, he had to provide for his family. He remained loyal to the prayer book, but he did it in a way that he wouldn't get in trouble with the authorities of the time. Hackett was one of sort of these subversive, like, Church of England men during the interregnum. So basically, they were the Puritans and the Presbyterians wanted extemporaneous prayers. They wanted, like, sermons off the cuff, all these things. And so Hackett did what several men did. They just memorized the Book of Common Prayer. And so they would use these Book of Common prayers and just kind of recite them. And, like, people who knew what they were doing got comfort for it, but people who didn't recognize it, they were thinking, oh, they have beautiful prayers here. And so they were able to kind of do some of the things that, like, the rituals for baptisms and burials with some of that for people who wish that orthodoxy. John Evelyn basically had a minister that he knew during the interregnum who could come and baptize his children.
Yeah.
Bury them when they passed, using the prayer book, but also doing it kind of incognito through memorization. And Hackett was one of those men as well. He will actually die in 1670, which is in the midst of this big conflict. Thomas Wood, on the other hand, was the third son. So he basically, there's the heir, the spare, and the church. So he basically followed that route. Mm. He was attached to a very influential family at court. His family had him appointed as a royal chaplain. He was also kind of a very bad priest. He baptized exactly one child in his entire clerical career, a girl, who he then later married, just to kind of make the way up
creepy the creepy circle of life thing going on there.
Yeah, he was 29 years older than she was. But she was the youngest sister of Sir James Clavering, who was a baronet. His wife's name was Grace. But the Claverings were attached to a very radical Puritan faction at Newcastle upon Tyne. So he marries into a radical Puritan fact as the dean of the cathedral. Okay, so he's supposed to be like, this is all, and he doesn't marry until 1666. So after the Clarendon Goes and passed, all of the rules about nonconformist and all of the things about associating with him have all gone into effect. He marries a noted Puritan. And not alone, just the creep factor. The whole, like, he baptized her as an infant and married her when she was not as an adult. Just, it's creepy to think
it
about
is
when
creepy
you tell
as hell, isn't it?
Very, and during the interregnum, because he had family money, Wood doesn't suffer at all. He goes on a grand tour. He spends time in Italy where he decides he hates popery. Shocking as a Puritan. He spends a lot of time abroad. He doesn't suffer any deprivation.
He just sounds like a total knob, doesn't he?
He wasn't a nice guy at all. Yeah. You're coming into people with, like, you're coming into contact with many of these men. And the only thing he was really interested in is that he'd been promised a prebend at the Restoration, so he got that as well. So he was hated not only in Lichfield, but he was also a prebend at the canon at the Cathedral of Durham. And it's kind of like both of them hated him. He was incredibly disliked, but he kept going on because he was so well connected, you know?
Even Erica sounds disgusted by him.
Yeah, yeah. She sounds very...
she's just finds him completely distasteful.
He is named the dean, largely through the machinations of his family. It's not his own... It's not on his own merit, let's put it that. His family arranged to have him named dean. He's a political kind of appointee.
He's just one of these guys that just gets handed everything, isn't he?
He was very lucky, very fortunate. And actually how he becomes bishop is part of a backrooms deal as well, which we'll get to. But so there's all this conflict, you know, like Hackett, who, and then there you have Wood. And so you have these two men who are like polar opposites personality-wise to begin with. Hackett was very well liked. His letters, for the most part, when you read his own writing, they're very friendly. In many respects, especially to the Archbishop, they had been friends for a long time. They had been royal chaplains together to Charles I as well. And he had a very friendly tone. And so when he's laying out his problems, it's more like he's approaching his friend than he is like, what do you want me to do about this? Is this what? And so because of that, in the Tanner manuscripts, you find these fantastic passages about Dean Wood. And I'm going to read you one because it's just
brilliant.
Fantastic. In 1668, Hackett wrote to Sheldon about the dean, kind of like laying out the initial problem. I will bring our illiterate dean on the stage and his lack Latin ridiculousness. First, he will keep no chapter, nor suffer any to be called, among other reasons, because the residentians bring forth statutes to him in Latin, and he understands not a line till Greswold puts it into English. He told Mr. Archibald he had not read a book these 2 years.
I love what lack Latin ridiculousness. That's a burn, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And there's like one, like, and they're real. That's like my favorite, his lack Latin ridiculousness, because he wasn't educated like the others. And of course, church records are kept in Latin still at this point, or a lot of them are kept in Latin. Some are kept in English. It just kind of depends where you go. In the cathedral chapters, it was an assumption that you were literate in at least one dead language. And he was, you know, he did have a BA, but he doesn't have the MA. And one of the big things that the dean of the cathedral is supposed to do is supposed to, like, make sure that they're the one who forms the rotation for the preaching duties of the cathedral. Like, who's supposed to lead the service when? That's one of their big jobs. Like, who's supposed to lead the services, or who's supposed to lead the prayers in cathedrals? Of course, you know, even now in lockdown, in London, the cathedrals are still doing. You have the canon, the dean, and sometimes the bishop leading different prayers, live streaming them now. But they're still doing that, and this is what had to go on in the day to day. It was a little more. There were a few more done then, but like this kind of like the activities, the daily life of a cathedral, that he refused to. And it was his job as the dean, okay? And he just kind of was like, nope. And this is one of the things that causes the conflict. The other thing has to do with the rebuilding of the cathedral. Everyone, the bishop, the prebends, the canons, all contributed to the rebuilding of Lichfield. Lichfield was in ruins. And so there was a great attempt to get it back where they could hold services in it, and it was a lot of work, and it was very expensive. They were given a great deal of money by Charles II, but they also raised money within the church from the cathedral clergy, and everyone was expected to contribute, and Wood promised to contribute, and then he wouldn't. And then to hide the fact that he didn't contribute, he basically took the register book, which had basically what everyone owed the church, and took it to his house, so he couldn't be called out on his debt.
If I just hide the evidence, it'll all be fine.
Yeah, basically. But they're like, wait, you're not... Well, one of the things, and this is one of the things that happens in Canterbury, is you're not supposed to remove the register books from the chapter house. They are the property of the cathedral chapter. The cathedral clergy are what they were... You're not supposed to remove the custos fabric. He does that, and then... Here's another passage I marked because it's just so fun. He marries in 1666 to his young wife, and... Basically, the peculiars are trying to get him to call a meeting so they can bring with the church, you have to call to bring in a charge. You have to do these things. They have to be done in order. And so the peculiars and the canons are all like, we need to bring you up. And so he just refuses to come into the cathedral. So he can't be presented with any paperwork. And so
that's a really grown up way of responding, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Hackett write in February. I wonder what he does at home, for he hath not stirred out of doors since the 23rd of December. Never came to public praises, nor his wife. She never comes to praises, but now and then, before Christmas, a sermon. And the 13 festival days of Christmas, which makes the Puritans mightily resort to him, whose patron he is upon all occasions, and it makes him as ridiculous as his lack Latin.
Ouch.
So basically, and there were like some of the complaints against Wood were legit. He refused to call the chapter meeting. One of the problems, there was a vicarage that was attached to the cathedral that had been vacant that needed to be filled by the chapter house. They had to decide there was some ruins the church owned that needed to be either like restored or destroyed. And, you know, so all of those sorts of things kind of like tie into the problems that they were having with him. And they finally, the canons and the bishop decide that Wood has been recalcitrant long enough. They will bring him up on charges of excommunication. And so a bishop can't excommunicate a member. And so Hackett excommunicated Wood, and his diocesan court announced the charge early in 1668. Okay, so at this point, Wood goes to Durham. He is living as a prebend in Durham. So he goes to Durham, creates problems in Durham. They don't like him there either.
Does anyone like him anywhere?
And he was very rude when he tried to do it. Wood will basically... deny everything. I didn't do that. That's not what it, like, you look, you took the stuff out, the, you know, it's pretty obvious. You know, I mean, there may be some exaggeration about the bishop, and, you know, he's irritated, but, like, the truth of the matter is, like, he was not super very, he was not good at his job.
Mm.
And so it just continues, and it's, it, there'll be more conflict. Wood will, Hackett will try to restore Wood. Hackett keeps trying. To his credit, he keeps trying to bring Wood into line. He keeps trying to do the right thing, to bring him back into the church, to have him, you know, bow the knee to the, you know, agree to be uniform. And Wood just refuses. Just, you know, he just, he's not interested. And Hackett will die in 1670. And this whole conflict is still unresolved. And normally when a bishop dies, the dean is often elevated to the see. And that's kind of, but deaneries are often seen as training grounds for episcopal sees. So a lot of times bishops will be promoted to a see. So this is where it gets even more interesting. And you get to the Duchess of Cleveland and the king and everyone else.
Yeah. How are they connected into this story?
Sir Henry Wood is Thomas Wood's oldest brother. And he was an influential courtier, and he was popular with the set around Barbara Villiers, the Duchess of Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
He was in that kind of that faster set around the king. And also what has happened by 1670 is the king is, you know, Charles II. He was very much influenced by who held sway in his bed, more so than any real devotion to anything. In the 1660s, the men who had supported his father and him had come to positions of power. But by 1670, many of them were old. They were critical of some of his lifestyle choices, let's put it that way.
Not his lifestyle choices are questionable in many cases, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think I've called him on this before, the randiest man ever to hold the throne of England.
Yeah, he still has descendants all around. There are still descendants of Charles II just popping up, you know, through DNA tests. Okay, so Sir Henry Wood was arranged to marry his only surviving child, who was his daughter, Mary, to the king's oldest son by the Duchess of Cleveland. Hmm. So you can see the kind of circles to this. And Wood would only agree to the arranged marriage between the king's bastard and his daughter, his only surviving child, if his brother was given the bishopric of Lichfield. So the king, because he wanted his son married, he wanted to keep Barbara happy. He wanted to keep Wood happy because he was probably funding some entertainments at this point.
To be fair, you need to keep Barbara happy.
You do, you do. And so Wood is given the bishopric of Lichfield, despite the protest of the canon. So everyone's kind of like, how did this happen? Well, they know how it happened, but they're just kind of like, really? Prior to this, like, Wood had had, before Hackett's death, Wood had had Hackett excommunicated. Hackett had had Wood excommunicated. They go up before the Court of the Arches. Basically, it's a mess, and it's being gossiped about in London. It's just not good for the church. It's not, it's just, he's just, and he's unrepentant. Wood is like, and every time you bring it up to him, he goes, I have done nothing wrong. Like, he's just one of these, I am innocent. I have done nothing wrong. Every time, you know, I married a Puritan. I have done nothing wrong. I, you know, I haven't been to church. I have done nothing wrong. I, you know, I haven't paid to rebuild the chapter. I have done nothing wrong. So basically over and over. And then he gets rewarded for this bad behavior, essentially. So then the second part of the story, John Hackett's, the Bishop Hackett's son, his eldest son, John, and Wood now get into conflict. So John Hackett II, basically over the position of his father's possessions as a bishop that should be divided among the bishop's heirs. And Wood doesn't want to give anything to Hackett's heirs, despite the fact some of the things were actually theirs. And so this has to go all the way through the court. At the same point, when Wood is replaced, Lancelot Addison became the dean of Lichfield. And eventually in 1683, and Wood is the bishop, and William Sancroft becomes Archbishop of Canterbury in 1677 after Gilbert Sheldon dies. And they've tried repeatedly to but he's too well protected. Wood is not a good bishop. He's kind of, you know, he's disinterested. He's not a, You know, and within all this kind of period where he's not doing what he needs to do, this is the time the Test Act is passed, where you have to be a member of good standing of the Church of England. You have to have taken communion once a year to hold any public, to be in Parliament, to be a member of the, and to be in the Navy. This is when the Duke of York is outed as a Catholic. There's lots of things going on. They're trying to like reorder society, and Wood's just not. So when Lancelot Addison becomes the bishop, and it kind of like just simmers for a long time, there's a lot of unease and a lot of distress, and Wood just gets a good, he's just like, I'm protected. But by the 1680s, the position is different. And this is because Charles II has no legitimate heir. And Wood is going to be forced finally to bow the knee to the ecclesiastical authorities because the king's position is going to shift. Charles II, by the 1680s, desperately needs the support of the church so that his brother can succeed him as king. The succession crisis is going to force Charles II to basically make, Wood is going to be forced to bend the knee because of things that happened in the 1680s. Mm. In 1683, Lancelot Addison becomes the Dean of Canterbury of Lichfield. He will send detailed reports to the Archbishop of Canterbury about Wood's bad behavior. And finally, in 1684, so 16 years after it began, Wood will be excommunicated once again, not get it overturned, and he will be forced to pay back what he owes and forced to bow to the ecclesiastical authorities. Because by 1684, Charles cannot afford to anger the churchmen. He needs them because of the secession crisis.
Yeah.
And the exclusion parliaments. He needs the support of the church. This whole high church, this church and king party, he needs them. And so he will finally bow the knee and it'll finally be solved. John Hackett will finally get the monetary response he owes. Wood was fined £2,565. Andrew Hackett, who was one of the slayers of John Hackett, had to pay £1,520. But basically, Wood was basically forced to prostrate himself before the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he lives pretty quietly after that. He's kind of watched. He doesn't get away with a lot. He doesn't try to interfere as much. He's an older man. He also, his health by this point was not great. He dies in 1692, but his health was declining as well. Wood leaves no children, so there's no sort of like settlement after that. What's also interesting about Lichfield is that several of the canons who, one of the canons who wrote against him, and his letters exist, actually nonjured. He was a nonjuring in 1690. So there's a very strong high church position in Lichfield, despite all this, the fact that the, and of course, Sancroft, of course, is the most famous of the nonjurors. Wood will be succeeded by William Lloyd, not the William Lloyd that nonjures, the other one. But it is just such a fun, crazy story. Like it just, you know, because it kind of, it's like a microcosm of like how fragmented the church was. In some ways, there was outwardly, it looked like it was very well put together and it recovered very strongly. But inside there are these fantastic stories of just craziness happening. And that was a rare thing. Most of the church, many people, when the church is restored, many people went back to the prayer book, went back into the fold of the Church of England very, very easily. You know, the Great Compton Census basically says less than 10% of the British, of the English population was anywhere close to having, ties to sectaries. And then of course it doesn't last, the settlement, because you know, at the Glorious Revolution, the whole idea of removing a legitimate monarch, when you've made church and king those two pillars of society, to remove a legitimate king creates,
they just
another...
didn't bank on James II being so bad though, did they?
Well, and you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, James probably would not have been that terrible as a king because he promised to protect the church, but there was such a fear of popery. It was both within the Church of England and without. It doesn't help that you have like the Popish plot and things that happen the same, you know, in within decades preceding this. You know, the Roman Catholic Church was like the great boogeyman. You know, they're, you know, be good or the Jesuits will get you. You know, what I think
like the legacy of Mary, isn't it?
Yeah, in many ways, but also, you know, even people like, you know, William Laud was a great, and even some of these people who they hated at different times, you know, everyone made their name by arguing with the Jesuits. That was how you made your name to defend Protestantism, is you went and argued with the Jesuits or a cardinal. Laud did this with great success, actually, among others. You know, it becomes quite interesting that, in the act of toleration, when it's passed, it makes the Church of England prime, you know, in Britain for ages until the Great Reform Act, I think, is when it changes. But it allows for the first sort of multicultural or multi-ethnic or multi-religious, at least Christian religion, in Britain. And it's always funny, I teach American history sometimes, often as well, and I always tell, we talk about the Puritans, and I'm like, you know, it is one of the great ironies of history that the Puritans are like, you know, going after witches. At the same time, the British Puritans are experiencing their first taste of religious freedom, because they're legally allowed to exist for the first time. And they two events at once, because it's funny. It's one of those great things that the Puritans were so, the Church of England is so terrible and awful. And then they go around and do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
They do it worse, because, you know, the fines that, you know, the Church of England, the fines for being a Puritan in the Restoration, a lot of times were monetary. You might go to jail. They weren't going to like kill you. They weren't going to banish you into the wilderness, you know? And so it is one of those great ironies that the Puritans were much, much more, I mean, they didn't burn people. That's the great thing. My students like, they didn't burn witches. I'm like, no, that's a European thing. It doesn't cross the Atlantic, thank God.
Thank you so much, Heather, for coming on to try and unravel just a little bit of the insanity that is 200 years of British church history following Henry VIII. It is a clusterfuck, isn't it?
But it's a fun one.
Yes.
Like, I think it's really interesting. And I think, you know, people, there's so much done on the Tudors. And I'm like, can you please, like, and they always make stuff up, like, about the Tudors. And the Tudors are so much, like, they kind of sensationalize them. I'm like, just look at the Stuarts. You don't even have to sensationalize anything. These people were crazy.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Alrighty. Thank you so much. It was wonderful to meet you.
Join us on Monday when Heather McAdam will be with us. She will be telling us all about her amazing best-selling book, The 999. This looks at a Slovakian shipment, the first Jewish shipment of women to go to Auschwitz in World War II. Don't miss that one.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year, and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them, so don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month, and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes, because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.